Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that seeks to look beyond mythical fantasy and delve into what's real, as in whether our intrepid partner Nathan is an actual person, or rather is the latest example of advanced artificial intelligence capable of rattling off opinions about cinema faster than IBM's Deep Blue computer can defeat a human chess master. We mere humans cannot compete. Anyway, myth is on the docket this week as we tackle two movie examples. The first is the latest release by Chinese master filmmaker Zhang Yimou, whose feature Full River Red tells the story of intrigue, betrayal, loyalty, and assassination set in 12th century China. And the second, titled Boston Strangler, explores the story of two women journalists who first broke the story long before the notion of serial killers were even a thing. Let's begin this week's show by turning the clock back 9 centuries. If you're not a scholar of Chinese history, and few of us are, Zhang Yimou's study of what happened between the Song and Jin dynasties in the middle of the 12th century may not make a whole lot of sense. Chinese audiences, though, aren't so burdened. Many are said to know the poem that so dramatically closes the film, sung to the tune Full River Red, which speaks of loyalty and the need to defend the home country against foreign invasion. Most U.S. movie fans, though, will have to be content trying to follow the film's various protagonists, many of whom are based on historical figures, who vie between themselves in various twisted intrigues involving treachery and revenge, and the meaning, not to mention the price required, of loyalty to a cause. As far from Zhang's best film, a short list of which includes Raise the Red Lantern, To Live, and House of Flying Daggers. But enough occurs with an occasional comic tone contrasting with the ongoing exercises in bloodletting to make the 2-hour and 39-minute running time feel not quite the viewing marathon you might expect it to be.
Well, I think the movie of his that most American audiences will know is one you didn't mention, which is Hero, which came out about 20 years ago and was a
Is that the one with Gong Li?
No, it's the one with Jet Li, and it's a big martial arts extravaganza, lots of color, and it's this mythical story. And that was a big hit in America. And his early career, you know, you mentioned Raise the Red Lantern and To Live, and Zhu Du is another one.
Yeah.
Those were big art house hits at the dawn of the 90s. And ever since those hits overseas, we hadn't really gotten many movies of his in the States. I saw a movie of Zhang's last year at the Seattle Film Festival called 1 Second, which I thought was the best thing I saw that year. And I don't even think it's gotten a U.S. release yet. I've been waiting for that movie to come out. So he's still making films in China. And Full River Red, his latest, was a massive hit over there. It's, I think, something like the 5th or 6th highest grossing movie at the Chinese box office in history.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are going to see this. And as you mentioned, I think those audiences are going to have more knowledge of the history and sort of the poem that you mentioned that gives the movie its title. They're going to know that, whereas I was not familiar with it. And I think there are great things in this movie. It's impossible for a Zhang movie not to have great things in it. I just kind of think there's much too much of it. I mean, you mentioned that it's 2 hours and 39 minutes. I did think it felt really long, especially because the way that it's structured is the movie opens and these guys are trying to essentially solve a mystery. Who killed this guy? And they've got 2 hours to do it.
Who killed this guy and why?
And why?
Did they kill him?
And essentially, they have to do it before the sun comes up. It is basically the setup here. And they're constantly running down the corridors and alleyways of this village.
Narrow corridors,
and the camera's kind of zooming around, and it has almost a screwball energy to it. I was actually thinking of the later scenes in that movie Clue, where all the characters are running from one place to another. And there is some broad comedy here because our main character, who is sort of this prisoner that has been, his head is basically on the chopping block unless they solve this case. He's sort of the village idiot. He's kind of the broad comic foil here, although we do discover that his character has unexpected complexities. So they're zipping around, and there's a lot of that. I mean, it's almost 90 straight minutes of that. And after a while, I was wrapped up in the cleverness of it, because every time you think they're about to crack the case, somebody ends up dead, or it turns out they're not who you thought they were, or they run away, and it just, the chess game continues. And after a while, it grew a little bit tiresome. And then the last half of the movie is much more earnest and becomes more of a straightforward, almost action film, a war film in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe if this had been tightened up a little bit, I wouldn't have felt the length of it, because it's set, like I said, it's almost in real time. Mm-hmm. And so it did wear a little thin for me. There are also things like any blockbuster, because don't get me wrong, Full River Red is a blockbuster, a Chinese blockbuster. Like any film made for mass consumption, it has moments of, let's just say it, straightforward emotional manipulation. I mean, you would see this kind of, you know, where the strings on the soundtrack swell and someone has a big tear-streaked monologue.
The music is a big part of this film.
And throughout most of the movie, there's this, it's very contemporary. It's this
like almost rap music.
Yeah, like hip-hop or house music that is kind of the main soundtrack. I actually really liked that
stuff.
I thought it was sounded really cool. So yeah, this is interesting, and I'd be curious to know what you both thought of it. I would agree that it's not up there with some of the other Zhang movies you mentioned, but again, he just has a way with the camera. Maybe we can talk a little bit about, and I'll definitely be talking about this with the Boston Strangler in the second half of the show, about the color in this movie and the way that it's lit. But I think the way that Zhang uses the camera is just, it's exhilarating to watch him, where you're like, oh, that's an interesting place to put the camera. I would not have thought of that. So the filmmaking is always unpredictable and dexterous in a way that the story kind of requires, because like I said, they are kind of ping-ponging from one location to another. And, you know, there's definitely pleasures to be had
here. Well, most of the film, it takes place in these small rooms and these little hallways, and people are going back and forth, and you're trying to remember who's where, because some people are hidden. Some people are, you know, as you said, moving back and forth, and you're trying to sort out where you are at any given point. And then it will open up sort of inexplicably to these broad sort of battle-ready scenes.
Vistas.
Right.
You go from like a
vistas,
drawing
right.
room mystery to a big like epic sweep of a
right.
Western.
And it was, you know, not knowing some of the history, I mean, it did take a little while to sort out
some of the history.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Not knowing any of the history, let me just put it that way. I mean, it was supposedly took place in 1196. Is that
1146.
Correct? Oh, 1146. Okay. See, I even got that wrong. But we haven't mentioned some of the different characters or performances here. And I really liked the performance by the one young woman who was the primary concubine.
Her name is Zither.
Yeah. And we had Plum and Zither and, yeah, all these sort of unusual names. And these women, I mean, at first we think they're these three innocents who've been swept into this plot and, you know, have no agency or control. And then we find out that there may be something different going on.
You could say
because
that.
One of them was actually quite the formidable opponent to the underlying sort of political and other maneuverings.
Yeah, and I think at this point it's pretty obvious that we're not mentioning the names of the actors simply because, for one, it's hard for us to pronounce them. And two, I'm not really familiar with any of them. Jackson Yee, who plays the Sun Commander, I mean, that's a name that's easy for me to pronounce. And these guys are probably really big stars in China. But it was hard enough for me to follow the story. I could tell the characters apart. I really enjoyed the cinematography. We were having this discussion before we went on the air. The subtitles did not help any of us at all to follow anything. There were mistakes, there were intrusions, there were typos,
just,
you know, different
mistranslations.
Mistranslations, yeah. And, you know, different verb forms, you know.
Yeah, and because there's so much dialogue happening in this movie, Full River Red,
and
whoever
machine gun time.
Yes, whoever designed the subtitles had them kind of up on the screen too quickly, so that sometimes they would say things and it would pass by before I could
even
read
thing,
it.
The other thing that was a little quirky was, at least when we were watching it, I mean, the subtitles were in Mandarin,
yeah,
and then they were in English,
yeah,
too. And so that was a little distracting as well. And I think that just when we thought AI had cornered the market on everything, apparently that is not true. We still need human translation, it seems.
And I don't know if this will still be in theaters by the time this airs, but I'm sure it will be streaming soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that if this gets, you know, a U.S. home video or streaming release, those subtitles will probably be, you know, fixed, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Oh,
but yeah,
maybe.
It was really distracting. And I think
depending
upon
the distributor, yeah,
we've been spoiled by really good subtitles, mm-hmm, on international films and non-English language films, so that this was just a little bit jarring.
So I think the point to make about Full River Red is that If you can, go see it with someone who's acquainted with Chinese culture and Chinese history. If not, if you're just like us, a mainstream movie fan, you might enjoy the cinematography. You might enjoy the music. Because as you pointed out, Nathan, there's always something about a Zhang Yimou film that is worth looking at, worth enjoying.
Well, we saw it on a beautiful sunny weekend afternoon when everyone else was, I'm sure, out enjoying nature. But the theater was pretty filled, and the entire row in front of us was taken up with Chinese students. And so I wanted to talk to them and sort of get their perspective. But that seemed a little intrusive.
But yeah, I think it's worth seeing for sure. Yeah.
And that was our discussion of Full River Red. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Boston Strangler. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Chinese film Full River Red. Let's now move to something a bit more current, the Hulu streaming film Boston Strangler. As written and directed by Matt Ruskin, Boston Strangler is far less exploitative than its title suggests. Instead of keying on the real-life murders which haunted the city of Boston in the early 1960s, and which are barely portrayed, Ruskin's script follows in the vein of last year's film She Said. It focuses on a pair of women newspaper reporters, Loretta McLaughlin, played by Keira Knightley, and Jean Cole, played by Carrie Coon, who were the first to put the pieces together and make a case that the Boston police could not, which was to point out that a serial killer, a term that hadn't even yet been invented, much less imagined, was targeting the city's single women. We watch as McLaughlin fights both her initially dismissive boss, played by Chris Cooper, and sexist police officials, not just to get information, but even to earn the right to investigate crimes that she comes to realize are connected. And we watch as she and Cole, after they become partners, are both used by their paper for publicity purposes and are resented at home by husbands who, having come to age in the 1950s, expect their wives to be less driven in their careers. Other than its portrayal of the difficulties faced by professional women, Boston Strangler offers one other surprise. The man credited for the murders might not have committed all of them.
Of course, a film such as this has the plot and the behind-the-scenes action that I gravitate toward. And so I must say up front that there were things I appreciated about this film, but in the end, it was a disappointment. And I'm not exactly sure why the Boston Strangler or Boston Strangler didn't quite work for me. And I think it did not have to do with the performances of the two main characters, because I did think that Keira Knightley, she wasn't initially convincing to me as somebody who was from the 50s, 60s era, but she grew on me. And then Carrie Coon's, I thought, was excellent. The problem was, I think you mentioned She Said up front, and I think that that was at least part of my problem with Boston Strangler, because we have seen this behind-the-scenes look at two women journalists tracking down a story and tracking down these leads and so forth. And I thought that that portrayal was superior in many respects. Also, I think this film was trying to figure out exactly what it was doing. So was it focusing on the relationship between these women? Was it focusing on the sexism that they had to encounter? Certainly, because I think some of the best scenes were when the Keira Knightley character, she's, quote, stuck on the lifestyle desk. So it wasn't even considered to be the features department back in the day.
She's reviewing a new toaster.
Yeah, they had, they gave her a Sunbeam toaster to review. And she's just sort of staring at it like, what am I supposed to do with this? And so I thought some of those scenes were funny and definitely accurate, even from my time coming of age in, you know, the professional world in the 1970s. And so I appreciated that. But also, as I said, was this supposed to be about Boston Strangler? That is the title of the film, and I don't know. I mean, they really don't, in the end, delve into that because there are still questions today about who, what, when, where, why. And I hoped that maybe we would have a little bit better framing of what actually transpired.
Well, neither of you have mentioned the elephant in the room when it comes to this movie, which I think this is basically like the store brand knockoff of it, which is David Fincher's Zodiac. This movie, Boston Strangler, is trying so hard to be David Fincher's Zodiac, and I think on just about every level fails. It certainly, I mean, again, that's a really high standard to meet. Don't
really,
get me wrong.
Exactly.
But the movie doesn't do itself any favors. But even the visual style, it's trying to do a David Fincher thing with the super muted colors and the almost chiaroscuro lighting and all of these kind of dramatic compositions. And it's just not the same because you go back to that movie and there was a sense of, I mean, we keep being told all these things, that the city is gripped by paranoia and fear and that, you know, there's this sense of obsession that the reporter characters are gripped with. And none of that comes through in the movie. They keep telling us these things and I don't feel it. Whereas Fincher's movie, again, one of the great movies of the century so far, captures that in every frame. And so this movie just doesn't live up to that. And I think it starts off promisingly, as you said, with the frustration that McLaughlin is feeling because she knows that she can bring something to this story. She's the one that starts connecting the dots, even though the dots at the end, it turns out, well, maybe we connected them in the wrong way, which is one of the fascinating wrinkles of this case.
Yeah, and also what the movie doesn't make clear, although seems to be somewhat the case, is that their reporting may have contributed to what might have been a movie that could be called Boston Stranglers rather than Boston Strangler.
So that part of the history of this, that there are theories that the guy that eventually was arrested for them,
Albert DeSalvo,
did not commit all of the crimes because the MOs and even the people that were targeted changed so completely over the course of what it was like 12 or 13 murders that he, you know, confessed to.
They connected him to one.
The ages of the victims, of the women who were murdered, let's not call them victims, let's just call them the women who were murdered, 19 to 85.
Right.
That's not your standard age rate for a serial killer.
Yeah, and so, you know, these things have kind of been debated over time. And so I knew about that going in, and I wondered if the movie was going to get anywhere near that because there's probably controversy surrounding just all of the theories about it. But it was interesting they went there. I also thought it was interesting that they brought up another movie with a similar title, The Boston Strangler, starring Tony Curtis, which was made and released when Albert DeSalvo was still alive and in prison. I mean, if you haven't seen
like
that
1968?
Movie,
1968,
something like that. Mm-hmm. If you see that movie, and I have seen it, but a few years ago now, it is
a few decades.
It is exploitation. Like, if you want a definition of exploitation, it is basically an art film that has exploitative goals. I mean, it is a fascinating curio if you ever want to go back and look at something that's going to kind of set your teeth on edge a little bit. But yeah, this movie, I'm kind of talking around this movie because I don't think it's very good, but this story is so fascinating. And there are so many
role of law enforcement
in the role of women in the newsroom. As you mentioned, there are so many fascinating elements to this. And I think you're totally right. The movie never lands on what it really is about. And I think we've seen so many true crime procedurals now that this just kind of pales in comparison.
And not to mention true crime procedurals, but also newspaper movies.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, we've seen some excellent ones over the last few years. Spotlight, just the one I mentioned before, She Said, last year. I mean, you and I had a back and forth a couple of days after we both saw this movie, and you were going, it's a bad movie. And I was going, it's not a bad movie. It's an ordinary movie. But then you made the point.
Yeah, and I was going to say, well, that's the ultimate sin. Especially now in this era of homogeneity, especially when it comes to movies. And I know that this is just a Hulu movie. It's not a big blockbuster. But I think the worst thing a movie can be is ordinary, especially when it's about something that, you know, shook this city to its core
and also deals
actually
with,
happening.
And also deals with issues that were important culturally.
And still are important.
Exactly.
Right. Violence against women. I mean,
Absolutely. Certainly.
And I think
Or just treatment of women, you know, in terms of career versus family, whatever.
Right. And the whole law enforcement perspective and how, in the past at least, law enforcement had been accustomed to the media joining forces with it to allay the fears and concerns of the public, even if it had nothing to do with truth. Well, and so I thought that that was, you know, another sub-theme.
And even another sub-theme was, as we, I think we reviewed the documentary about the Golden State Killer, and it was talking mm-hmm. about even as late as the 80s and 90s, a lot of departments weren't
communicating with one another.
And they
right.
certainly weren't in Boston, not even from one county to the next.
And that's why a lot of these cases eventually went cold, is because the wires weren't connecting. I do want to say, as far as the Boston Strangler movie goes, I do want to talk about some of the good things, because I don't think this is an out-and-out failure.
What,
were you involved in the production? You're welcome. I mentioned the visual style with those muted colors. Apparently, bright colors weren't invented until the 1970s, because this movie is, I think it's ugly. They have desaturated it to such a degree where I just think, just make it black and white. Go all the way. Like, why have it? Everything is brown and beige. And I didn't like that at all. But I want to say that I really like Carrie Coon. And anytime she shows up in something, I mean, she's a Fincher, you know, she's been in Fincher
regular,
movies.
Regular, right.
And I really like her character here, to the point that when she went missing for a big chunk of the movie, I thought, what's Carrie Coon doing? I would like to follow her character.
We were both cheering when they were smoking and drinking in the bar, you know.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, so we did have some sympathetic male characters, almost too stereotypically presented. So we had the police officer played by Alessandro Nivola, who, you know, was trying to help, but, you know, he couldn't really go too far out.
I didn't care about any of them. I didn't care about any of them. I just wanted to see Keira Knightley and Carrie Coon smoke and drink in the bar.
And that was our discussion of the Hulu streaming film Boston Strangler. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. Earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Mary Pat Truthart and I discussed the Chinese import Full River Red. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the writer Adrian Tchaikovsky, taken from his novel Elder Race. Myths miss out all the sordid realities and preserve only what we wish we'd done rather than how we actually did it. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.